This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Dr. Michael Lewis joins us. He's a public health infectious disease expert and former U.S. Army colonel. He was actually stationed at Ground Zero in Southeast Asia during the breakout of SARS in 2003. And can talk about some of the things that he saw then that may be repeating itself now, which is very interesting. And we've talked to other experts about this, you will recall, just the other day, that made some of the same observations. Dr. Michael Lewis, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, Noel.
Doc, I obviously, as an infectious disease expert for the U.S. Army, you were one that probably traveled the world looking at, I guess, the frailty of so many different fronts, and that's what's led us to this pandemic. What, in your experience, what have you seen? What have you seen here, and what are the similarities?
Well, the obvious similarities is it's where this coronavirus is from, and the fact that it is a coronavirus. But pretty much the similarities seem to end about there. A lot of the symptoms, of course, are very much the same, but the infectiousness of this particular COVID-19 is far greater than what SARS was. And while the interestingly enough, the mortality is actually not as bad as SARS, but the rate of infection, the rate that it's being passed between people, is much worse with this one.
Interesting when you say that the mortality is not as great. I it's the first time hearing that, because everybody thinks we're off and running and are going to set, like, new records, right?
Well, new records and as far as numbers of people, but percentage of fatalities of people that actually get infected with this virus is actually pretty significantly low. It just, when it reaches so many people, of course, even a low percentage, all those numbers are going to add up.
Right, right. What did you see? You were in Southeast Asia during the breakout of SARS. And what did you see then as it related to the response to SARS, and as to what you know now in the response to COVID-19, and if there were any similarities there?
Well, with SARS, people got sicker quicker. With the COVID-19, people can walk around potentially for a week before they really start to develop symptoms. And so early on, as you can imagine, you could be exposed. You could actually be in the process of getting sick but not really know it and jump on an airplane and fly around the world. And that's part of the reason why it spread as quickly as it did.
So what does it say about, obviously everybody gathers intel, and there is a thing, you know, called medical intelligence, as you well know, because you were an expert in kind of identifying that. What does it say as it relates to these relationships that we have with other countries and their desire or willingness to be completely open and transparent? Because it seems to me that the sooner that you get your arms around this and identify what it is that you're actually dealing with, the safer you make the entire world.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, that was the reason why the Army had me stationed in Southeast Asia, you know, now almost 20 years ago, was to try to develop those relationships between countries and partners. And so my job literally was to develop partnerships so that we could identify problems early on. And that's what really, I think, we're missing right now, or have been missing. I mean, it's a little bit too late at this point. That's what the WHO should be doing. That's what some of these international organizations should be doing. And, you know, some cultures, some countries, some administrations of those particular countries are very closed and not very forthcoming, and pressure needs to be put on some of those. You know, the transparency we have here in the United States, it's easy to think, well, the rest of the world should be like that. But unfortunately, the rest of the world isn't like that.
You know, and I think back to SARS, I recall that there was a physician who actually wrote a letter to the media and kind of blew that thing all wide open out of China. And, you know, and then he's been in jail ever since for any number of issues. And we see some of the same things here where a physician began talking to other physicians who were talking amongst themselves. They started sending up the red flags and they all get pulled in and allegedly quarantined. But one gets convicted of a misdemeanor of trying to mislead the public or whatever it may be. We're seeing, I mean, it's amazing when you look at the patterns here, they're exactly the same, except the first time with SARS, a lot of folks credit that doctor to really preventing that from really becoming a significant pandemic.
Well, and it wasn't just the doctors in China. Part of why SARS was able to be understood quicker was that it kind of went through Hong Kong and then jumped over to Hanoi, and with actually an Italian doctor, Carlos Urbani, in Hanoi, who raised the real big red flag saying, hey, world, this is a bad thing going on here. And so we were fortunate that in that particular case that we were able to get the word out a little bit quicker so that things could start to clamp down in this, you know, testing and isolation or quarantining was able to happen much quicker with SARS. Whereas, you know, it was really bad timing this time around when, you know, this virus started going through Wuhan, the area in China, right in time for winter holidays and tens of millions of people traveling to and from Wuhan to around the world. And so it was both a combination of the lack of transparency in China, but really more so just really bad timing with people, tens of millions of people traveling around the world infected.
Doctor, you've seen all the data, and most of it is pointing to the month of December. And there's now some recent intelligence reports coming out that are saying that they began intercepting communications that indicate that they were definitely dabbling with this problem in November. When you look at it and your assessment of all of this information, are you convinced that probably by December we may have already had a case, or in early January in the U.S., and that the lead time may have gone back to even October over there in China?
If I had to pinpoint, and this is just purely a guess, I would say that it probably really started to become an issue more likely in November, I think a little bit earlier than what we understood. But, you know, it was interesting if you're following, the flu vaccine, for example, this past winter was not a very good match for the strains that were circulating. And so I think that muddied the waters a bit as well. And a lot of people I know, and this is just personal anecdote, is a lot of people I know had very similar symptoms to what we're now describing as the COVID-19 back in December and January. So yeah. I think it would be great. It would be great science to be able to start to test some people on a population level to see what's the antibody levels in your in their general population, in addition to the fact that we really need much better testing and more aggressive epidemiology, field epidemiology, you know, tracking cases, and we need good testing for that. But the idea of looking at antibodies and who's been exposed in the past, I think, would be incredible, incredibly important knowledge to know.
Yeah. Doc, you were stationed at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, and while there, you helped develop an infectious disease early warning system called the ESSENCE system. Is that a system that's still in place and still in use today?
Well, interestingly enough, a lot of the data you see, which is being reported out at Johns Hopkins University, is based on the ESSENCE data. The CDC puts tens of millions of dollars behind the ESSENCE program. It's really the basis of what they call their BioSense program and their National Syndromic Surveillance Program. So it's used not just at the national level, but many state and local health departments use it around the country, and actually a number of countries and cities around the world.
And is that where we would hope to have this reveal itself first, is through data comparison, data analytics that runs through ESSENCE combined with medical intelligence that we're reaching out across the world and trying to see trends that are going on and you know, based on chatter?
It is definitely one of the input sources that's being evaluated. It's really, so the ESSENCE program was really, I developed it really to look at, you know, people don't go to the hospital or to a clinic or to the emergency room with a diagnosis. They go with symptoms, and the symptoms are captured electronically, principally through financial and insurance issues, but it was really based on the Department of Defense data. And so we figured out how to basically data mine that data to be able to see, are things like unexplained fever or lower or upper respiratory complaints out of the norm for that week of the year, that day of the week, and a number of other variables. And so it's not a diagnostic tool, it's an early warning system. It raises a red flag saying, hey, we're seeing lots of unexplained fevers at the emergency room in Bethesda, Maryland. Pick up the phone and call somebody there and find out, you know, what's going on.
Right. So you have dashboards when things appear that are out of the norm, bells and whistles go off, and somebody goes and looks at it and gets intuitive about it.
Exactly. And back when we started it now 20 years ago, as far as influenza, the CDC usually, it took them 6 to 8 weeks to even identify an influenza outbreak, or really the peak of influenza, because, of course, there's a peak every year. We were able to do that in basically 2 to 3 days. So we were able to shorten that time frame from weeks to really almost hours. And that, you know, helps the public health system to be able to jump on board, as well as perhaps better staffing for emergency rooms, because we're seeing this influx of fevers and other influenza-like illness.
Based on your experience, what's your level of confidence as to how we are assessing where we are with the disease at the present time?
I think we need better testing. We need more aggressive testing. I think that we've been slow on the industry side of things to really get that testing available, developed and available and out there. Whereas in some cases, and I'll point out Seattle as an example. I mean, if you think about it, a month ago, everybody was, you know, Seattle is ground zero, and it's just, you know, it's going to be a disaster out there. We don't even hear about Seattle anymore, because University of Washington, as a university, they stepped in and they started making testing available very aggressively. That public health system used testing and contact tracing, did the field epidemiology that needed to be done. And subsequently, they were able to keep that outbreak under very good control. It really should be a model for how we should be going about this around the country.
Yeah, we have had a similar experience here in Louisiana. We've actually tested more people per capita than any other state in the country thus far. I think we're beginning to feel a little bit of a flattening. You know, you got to look at it, I guess, week over week as opposed to day over day. You know, and I love to see seven consecutive days of data. Is there a number or a safe harbor place where you look for as to looking at this data to be indicative of maybe the start of a flattening out of how many days of data that you're comfortable with?
Well, one of the things that I've been following is a system that's tracking the percent, not just the numbers of deaths and the numbers of cases, but looking at the acceleration or deceleration. And what we're finding is that the number of cases, while it's still increasing, that increase on a percentage level is slowing down. Right. And once that acceleration slows and hits zero and starts to decelerate, that's when we know we've gotten over the peak. But right. We're definitely seeing a significant slowing of the acceleration, but we're still seeing, of course, more cases on a daily basis. Nationally, New York, New Orleans, some of the hotspots, but you know, we also remember that diseases happen locally, and so they really need to be addressed locally. What happens in New Orleans is not the same thing that needs to be happening in Montana or Des Moines, Iowa.
Yeah, you know, I read an article this morning too, and it kind of caused some concern on in Reuters about South Korea. And they're wondering whether or not a number of the patients that had been cleared had it, and they had a test that came back negative after they had it, have been they don't know if they're reactivating or they've been reinfected, but they have the symptoms again. And so they're tested again, and now they're testing positive yet again. I guess, you know, most of the time these viruses work where you develop enough antibodies so that you'll be able to fight off a reinfection within a very short period of time of after having it, correct? Do we know enough about this one?
I don't think we know enough. And I'm looking at some of the genetic analyses of this virus. And here's one of the things that we know about viruses is they change pretty rapidly over time and over distance. And so the virus that maybe started to circulate and come out of Wuhan, China, in November, December, is not the virus that we're seeing in New Orleans. In fact, we may be seeing, you know, a variant of a virus in New Orleans versus what we saw in Seattle versus what we saw in New York versus what we're seeing in Europe. And so, in fact, I was just reading that the virus that we're seeing in New York, they are able to genetically trace it to Europe, actually, and not direct from China. So these things do change over time and over distance. So it's really hard to say whether or not it's a reinfection with a almost new virus or a variant of the old virus versus a reactivation. I don't think we know that yet.
Too many challenges, too many uncertainties. This story will change over time. Dr. Michael Lewis, thank you so much for joining us. We truly appreciate it.
And hopefully we can stay safe out there and keep calm and keep moving on.
All righty. Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. Got to take a break. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.